If you'd like to open your Bibles again, we're going to read from Psalms. We're going to read Psalm 49. This is one that will be helpful for the sermon a little bit later on. We're going to read from verse 5 through to verse 15. That's Psalm 49. Why should I fear in times of trouble, when the iniquity of those who cheat me surrounds me? Those who trust in their wealth and boast of the abundance of their riches. Truly, no man can ransom another or give to God the price of his life. For the ransom of their life is costly and can never suffice, that he should live on forever and never see the pit. For he sees that even the wise die, the fool and the stupid alike must perish and leave their wealth to others. Their graves are their homes forever, their dwelling places to all generations, though they have called lands by their own names. Man in his pomp will not remain. He is like the beasts that perish. This is the path of those who have foolish confidence. Yet after them people approve of their boasts. Like sheep they are appointed for Sheol. Death shall be their shepherd, and the upright shall rule over them in the morning. Their form shall be consumed in Sheol, with no place to dwell. But God will ransom my soul from the power of Sheol, for he will receive me. Well, the text Matt will be preaching from is Matthew chapter 16, so if you'd like to turn there, we'll read that. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and chief priests and scribes, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan, you are a hindrance to me, for you are not setting your mind on the things of God, but on the things of man." And then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Truly, I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom."
Well, there was a long, long time ago, in a faraway land and a faraway place, so far removed from the here and now that you might think it a world different altogether. There was a simple villager named Simon Bar Iona, and each day he and his brother would leave well before daybreak and cast their wide nets into the deep blue sea. The catch would differ from year to year, from season to season, and from day to day. They never went hungry, but they would never become rich. And Simon Bar Iona was happy enough with this. It was, after all, the life of his father, the life of his father's father, and his before him. I mean, it would be crazy to wish for anything else. And yet, if we were honest, in his quieter moments, he felt a deep yearning within him, a yearning to be something else, someone else, someone great. And Simon couldn't exactly put his finger on the reason why, but he knew that one day his dreams would come reality. One day he would become great. And so, as Simon silently watched the waves go by, the seasons and years gently roll by, he dreamed his dream of greatness. And then one morning that gave no hint of anything special, out of the blue, something happened. And in an instant, his distant dreams of glory and power became a reality. But before we get carried away with Simon, let's bring it back to us for a moment. I want you to think about your own dreams. What do you hope for yourself, for your family in the future? I'm going to give you 20 seconds now to create an image in your mind of your idealized future, of what your future would look like if all your dreams became reality. Where do you want to be? What do you want to be doing? And who are you going to be doing it with? Okay, so I'm going to give you 20 seconds now. Take a picture in your mind of that idealized reality. Okay. Hope you've taken that photo. If not, take it now. We'll come back to that mental photo in a little bit. But first, back to Simone. It was now 3 years after that fateful morning where the course of his life had changed forever. The man that he'd met that morning, the man that had called him from his boat, the man that was sometimes frustrating and always brilliant, that man, he'd finally worked out who he was. And we pick up the story in chapter 16, verse 13. Matthew 16, 13. Now, when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And they said, "Some say John the Baptist, others say Elijah, others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets." He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" Simon Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I tell you, you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Then he strictly charged the disciples to tell no one that he was the Christ. You see, Simon Bar-Jonah, Simon Peter, had finally worked out who he was. Jesus was the Messiah, God's promised anointed king. And Peter knew what that meant instantly. Anyone in his place in his day would have instantly known what it meant for Jesus to be the Messiah. He was going to lead Israel against her enemies. He was going to conquer the Romans. He was going to be a ruler like King David, like Moses, but greater. He was the person that Israel had been waiting for a millennium, 1,000 years. And Peter was his right-hand man. Peter was going to get the keys to the kingdom of heaven. I mean, dreams of power and glory are one thing, but to actually be told you're going to receive the keys to the kingdom of heaven? All his dreams were about to come true. Those dreams he'd gathered so slowly over the years seemed like they were about to be fulfilled. And then in one sentence, they are violently torn down. Verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem, suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and the scribes, and be killed, and on the third day raised. No! That's not right! That is not what the Messiah does. Kings rule, they don't die. Verse 22, and Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall never happen to you." This was not the path of glory that Peter had hoped for. This was not the power that he sure was in his grasp. Jesus responds, verse 23. Jesus turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." You see, Jesus saw right through, as he always does, saw right through Peter's rebuke. He wasn't motivated by love. Simon Peter wasn't worried about Jesus dying. He was rebuking Jesus for not fitting in with his plans, or as Jesus put it, his concerns for the things of man. And coming back to us for a moment, it makes us wonder, how does God fit into the dreams that we have for our life? When I gave you that 20 seconds to conjure up that idealised future, I've got no idea what it looks like in your mind. But I think I can have a punt, I guess, at what the average Australian's dreams are made of. Now, of course, the dreams of an 8-year-old are going to differ to that of an 18-year-old and will be barely recognisable to an 80-year-old. But I think I could guess the common elements in the dreams of those mature in years, those in the middle of years, and those in younger years. So for those more mature in years, I think the Australian dreams are likely characterised by comfort and security, a quiet retirement, good grandchildren, travel plans, good health, and enough super to get you through. For those in the middle, the dreams would be slightly different, I think. Paying off the house, perhaps. High-achieving children, job promotions, satisfying marriage, friendships. And for those younger in years, the dreams would be different again. Good marks, great travel, experience, high-flying career, sporting success, making a difference. I can still remember before I went to university. I wasn't a Christian at that time, but I dreamed big. I had dreams of being a CEO with a G4 Gulfstream jet, houses in New York and Milan, a Bugatti Veyron to drive and Bulgari gold to wear, exotic travel and exotic partners. I was doing an arts degree, so it's fairly unlikely. But I dreamed big. I dreamed like Simon Bar Yonah. I wonder whether your dreams are anything like these. And I think the question that the passage forces us to ask is, are our dreams of the future God-centred or man-centred? Let me ask, in that image you made, what was the role that God played in that? Was he at the centre of your dreams? Was he at the periphery of your dreams? Was he, in fact, at all even in your dreams? Well, there's another question you can ask to test this, I think. Another question. If God was subtracted from the equation, would my vision of the future change at all? Take God out of the picture, and does my picture change? Because if you take God out of the picture and your picture of your future does not change, then I think our dreams are shown to be man-centred, not God-centred. Were your dreams for the future God-centred or man-centred? Well, maybe you're a little confused. Maybe you don't really know what it would look like to have God at the centre of your plans. Maybe you're asking, what would a God-centred future look like? And if that's your question, great. It's a good question. I've prepared to answer it, which is good. And I think the passage itself actually answers it. Verse 24. Then Jesus told his disciples, "If anyone would come after me, let him deny himself, take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." What would a God-centered future look like? It would be selfless, cross-shaped and hope-filled. A God-centered future would be selfless, cross-shaped and hope-filled. One, it would be selfless. Well, I wonder if you spotted the common thread that ran through Peter's dreams, my early days uni dreams, or the dreams of the world around us. What is the common element? The self. You see, it doesn't really matter if your dreams are for world domination and universal glory, or a simple life in the suburbs. What drives many of our dreams is the self. What will make me happy? What will make me respected, secure, and satisfied? The concerns of Peter, the concerns of man, are the concerns of self. But have a look at verse 24. The very first thing that Christ commands us to do is to deny ourselves. Because a God-centered future involves removing us from the center of things. And can I say, that's not easy. That's not easy taking yourself out of the picture. You see, the world around us is driven and defined by self. If you have a look at the slides behind me, these are two I just picked up while Googling. So keep calm and love yourself. First, love yourself. Love yourself first. And the next one, I think. To love oneself is the beginning of a lifelong romance by Oscar Wilde. It's not only true of our generation, but every generation. Man, in his nature, seems to be bent in on himself, living for himself. It's our natural impulse and it's the world around us. And to deny yourself, to remove yourself from the picture, is no mean feat. And yet a God-centered future must be a selfless future. But how do we do it? If we take ourselves out of the equation, what replaces us? Is there merely a vacuum? Well, I've said we're after a God-centered future. So what exactly does a God-centered future look like? Well, the next point, I think this brings it to us. It is a cross-shaped future. So if you have a look at verse 24, Jesus' next two commands are to take up our cross and follow him. Deny ourselves, take up our cross and follow him. Well, I wonder what image is conjured in your mind when Jesus asked you to take up your cross. Maybe you have an image of a man bent over, carrying a heavy wooden object. It doesn't seem to be used that commonly these days, but I do remember a time in Christian circles when to carry your cross was an expression used when someone had to do something particularly hard or had a difficult person to deal with. Ah, you're on the kitchen duties with Philip. Shame. I guess we all have to carry our cross. But that has absolutely, absolutely nothing to do with what Jesus is saying here. Jesus is not saying my followers must do hard things. No, Jesus is saying that my followers must be willing to die. You see, carrying your cross as an expression only makes sense in light of the nails, the nakedness, the suffocation and the suffering. Jesus is calling us to a radical picture of life. A life where we're willing to die for him. And remember the context here. Jesus is talking to the disciples. This isn't some hypothetical abstract scenario whereby if I moved 4,000 miles in four different centuries ago, this might be a reality. 11 of the 12 people that Jesus was talking to, church history preserves, were martyred. And for many of our brothers and sisters in the Middle East, in Northern Africa today, crucifixion isn't an ancient practice. It's not some distant reality. It is a day-to-day threat. You see, those people well know what it means to take up your cross and follow Jesus. And Jesus has every right to call us to that standard because he took up his cross for us. Bearing the torture of the cross for our sake. But for you and me, if we stay in sunny Perth, it will be many generations before I think we get persecuted in that way for our faith, if indeed that happens. So what does it involve living in Perth carrying our cross? Well, there's no one-size-fits-all answer to this question. But I do take it that it means being willing to sacrifice anything and everything for Jesus. A willingness to give up career and comfort, livelihood and wealth, perhaps even being a missionary to a part of the world where your life is at stake. Now, Jesus isn't commanding us to do that here, but he is saying that we must be willing to do that. Because if you're not willing to die for Jesus, then Jesus says you're not following me. It might look like giving away your wealth to the poor, moving from Applecross to Armidale. It might look like starting a Bible study in your retirement village and enduring the drop in social status that will ensure. Sharing the gospel with your co-workers, knowing of the humiliation and awkwardness that that usually brings. It might involve volunteering your time for those in need, giving up your leisure activities out of love for others, foregoing sleep and food to fast and pray. It could take 1,000 different permutations, and I'm not about giving you rules. That's not what God's about. But what it is about is putting God at the centre, others at the centre, and removing ourselves. A life of radical self-sacrifice. So a God-centred future is selfless and it's cross-shaped, and lastly it is hope-filled. Verse 25. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of the Father, and then he will repay each person according to what he has done. Well, we started this evening with the story of Simon Bar Chiona, Simon Peter, the Apostle Peter. And tonight we're going to end the sermon with two stories, the story of Mick and the story of Jim. Simon's tale of glory and power showed us that the concerns of man leave no room for the concerns of God. Mick and Jim's story show us the hopelessness of a life centred on the self and the hopefulness, let's pretend that's a word, the hopefulness of a life centred around God and others. Mick, to begin with. Well, I only learnt about Mick this Monday morning past. I've changed his name for the purposes of the story. But Mick was one of Perth's wealthiest men. In fact, he owned for a long time Perth's biggest yacht, which is pretty impressive in Perth. He owned one of the biggest houses in Peppermint Grove. There was nothing that Mick's money couldn't buy, or so Mick thought. Mick was diagnosed with cancer in his early 40s. And it was an aggressive cancer, but he got to it early enough. And this early detection, coupled with his ability to write blank checks, his endless financial resources, meant the doctors had every confidence that Mick would pull through. However, this confidence was slowly replaced by a sense of fear and foreboding, because the cancer was not responding to any of the treatments. It was spreading, unabated, violently. Mick got sicker and sicker. But Mick didn't only get sick. Mick got more desperate and he got more angry. Why could the doctors do nothing? He could pay for anything. He could write a blank check. And Mick became the patient that no doctor and no nurse wanted to treat, because the worthlessness of his money did not humble him, but it embittered him. You see, Mick was used to money solving everything. Slowly but surely, however, he began to realise that there are some things that money cannot buy. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? You see, a man-centred life is ultimately a life without hope. But a God-centred life is a hope-filled life. Well, Jim was 27 when he left. He left the USA to Ecuador. 27 when he left, 28 when he died. The people that Jim Elliot went to live with were a violent and dangerous people. Jim knew that. Everyone back home knew that. And when someone told him that it is a fool's errand, a foolish task, going somewhere you will most likely die, Jim responded, and thanks to God, preserved his response in his journal. In the face of his imminent death, Jim said, "He is no fool who gives up that which he cannot hope to keep to gain that which he cannot ever lose." He is no fool who gives up that which he cannot hope to keep to gain that which he cannot ever lose. You see, Jim understood that the Christian life was a selfless and cross-shaped life. Jim knew that a Christian future might be a short future on this earth, but he also knew that a Christian future was a hope-filled future for eternity. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. Let me close by saying, don't be like Simon and Mick and have your dreams shaped and centred on the world around us, on merely human concerns. For they are ultimately hopeless dreams. No, have your future and dreams centred on God. Selfless, cross-shaped, but hope-filled dreams. Amen.
Have taken, leaving all to follow you. Destitute, despised, forsaken, need to please in all I do. Perish every fond ambition, all I sought and hoped and known. Hear how rich is my condition. Lord and have not still my own. Let the world despise and leave me. They have left my Savior too. Human hearts and looks deceive me. You are not like them. Service made his pleasure, with your favor lost this game. I have called you Abba Father, I have stayed my heart on thee. Souls may howl and clouds may gather, all must work for good. Then on from grace to glory, upward.